Those who would like to go to the toilet, please go. Go to the letting go rooms. Those who are here, stay here. And in a moment, I will begin this evening's Dhamma talk on all sorts of stuff. And maybe just what's a nice thing to do is, many of you may not know that in the bushfires in Esperance, unfortunately, that one of the people who passed away, Anna Winter, used to come here. She was a member of the Kalyanamitta group, came here quite a few times. So she died in the bushfires in Esperance. I'm sure that there'll be something done later on. So I'm going to dedicate the merits of this talk to Anna Winter, the Norwegian girl who passed away. It does happen. So anyway, having said that, there's another thing which happened last week. And people have asked me, can you please, Sanjay Prabhu, say something about this? Without making it too negative and too much of a downer, because I know that many of you come here, you've been working all day today and all week Friday, and the last thing you want is to have things which upset you on a Friday night. This is a few funny stories, nice interesting things, bit of laughter. And hopefully I'm going to introduce maybe some few inspiring stories and even a joke in one of the most difficult situations about the Paris and the Beirut terror attacks. And, you know, sometimes I really push my luck, but I'm going to do a joke about that later on. Just to keep things, you know, in some sort of perspective. So, you know, it's been dominating the news and conversations for the last week. So what's a Buddhist response to that? You know, and how can, you know, we deal with such things in our modern world? And the first story which, you know, comes to my mind, you know, when I sort of decide to just to talk off the cuff. Actually, I don't have cuffs, but if I did, it'd be talking off the cuff about these events which some people get really worried about. And that is that, you know, why is it that people just, you know, believe in the paraphernalia of religion rather than the religion itself? And there was a story which I told. I mentioned this at the conference which we held in August, quite a few months ago now. It's a story which I developed. I didn't read it anywhere. I developed, and it's, you know, it's in one of my books, and it's gone around the world. It's quite helpful. It came about many, many years ago when there was a lot of publicity about an accusation of a US Marine putting a copy of the Quran in a toilet, in flushing it down the toilet in Guantanamo Bay. And many people got very upset about that as disrespect to religions. And it did happen that the Australian newspaper, one of their journalists, called me at Bodhinyana Monastery down at Serpentine, and he said he was doing an article, you know, on that story, and his angle was to ask leaders of all the major religions in Australia the same question: if someone took one of your holy books and flushed it down the toilet, what would your response be? And he'd already, you know, asked the Anglican Archbishop of, I think, Sydney, you know, the Catholic Archbishop Pell, I think they asked, the head rabbi in Sydney, and a few other sort of people. Now he came to the Buddhists. One of the reasons they asked me, because I'm one of the few senior Buddhist monks who can speak English. So he called me and said, "This is a question, what's your answer? What would you do, Ajahn Brahm, if someone took a Buddhist holy book?" And you see the size of those holy books, we have them on sale in the library. "If they took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down your toilet, And without hesitating at all, because you know my character, you've known me a long time, many of you, I said, "Sir, if someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down my toilet, my first response would be to call a plumber." Because I have to use that toilet. One thing about Buddhism, it's very practical. And he laughed, and he said, "Wonderful, that's the most sensible answer I've got." Because sometimes we forget that laughter is a valid response. Sometimes that people do these terrible things to try and upset you, to try and make you angry, to try and even make you violent. And laughter is actually standing back and looking at it in a totally different way. One thing I've always found about laughter, when you laugh, everybody laughs as well. But I said, okay, now serious. And this is where I developed a wonderful way of looking at these things. And I said, "Sir, you can take every Buddhist scripture you want and flush it down all the toilets in this world. And you can take Buddha statues and blow them up. You can burn down all the temples. You can kill all the monks and nuns. But I'll never allow you to destroy Buddhism. I'll never allow you to flush peace, forgiveness, love, truth. I won't allow you to flush that down the toilet. Because I made a great distinction between the container and the contents. Buddha statues, scriptures, monks, nuns, temples, these are containers. What is that Buddha statue behind me? What's it supposed to represent? The place here, what do we do here? What actually do the books say? The books actually say, make peace, be kind, be gentle." So I said, "Look, you can blow up all the temples and the Buddha statues and the monks, but I'll never allow you to ever to blow up, you know, what Buddhism stands for. Peace, kindness, gentleness, forgiveness. Because that is the contents, not the containers." And I think one of the problems with our modern world is because we worship containers, not the contents. And no matter what religious leader it was, sometimes, yeah, we maybe know what they said, but what did they mean by what they said? And how much was it contextual at that particular time? It made sense then, but it doesn't make sense anymore. Truth is universal and eternal, but the way it's expressed in time and place will always be changing. And that's the basic rule, and that's one of the reasons why. Yeah, I know the Buddhist scriptures, but you interpret it, put them in new metaphors, new ways of looking, but keep the essential message of letting go and peace. The Buddha never said anything about a cup and putting it down. I made that up. But it represents something which, you know, the Buddha would say, yeah, this is what letting go is. So remember the contents. Keep the contents, but forget about the containers. So this is one of the reasons why, that yes, we do have holy scriptures. Yes, we do have symbols. Yes, we do have clergy, the monks and nuns. But that isn't Buddhism. Buddhism is different from the containers. It's the contents. What are these monks and nuns symbols of? What is a Buddha a symbol of? Many people have Buddha statues these days, and they have them in their gardens. And sometimes people complain, "Ajahn Brahm, you should do something about this. They're not respecting the Buddha. They're putting in the garden all over the place." But look, why do they have it there? And I don't know if you know this, I've said it a few times, but one of our monks some years ago, he went to visit England, he was an Australian monk, and you know, his host said, "Let's go and see a castle. You know, it's what you do if you're in Australia visiting England, go and see a castle." So they went to the castle was closed. You know, got the day wrong. And so, oh crikey, what should I do now? And so not far away from the castle was another place where tourists would visit. It was the home of the wartime Prime Minister of UK, Winston Churchill. So they went to go and visit Chartwell. That's where he used to hang out. And so when they went into the door, you know, of the big mansion where he lived, the monk was really surprised to see on the entrance wall a painting, which was done by Winston Churchill, of a Buddha statue. He said, "What's that doing there? You know, he's supposed to be a Christian, not a Buddhist." And the curator said that that was a painting of a real statue which Winston Churchill had by his bed throughout the Second World War. Next to his bed, where he went to sleep at night, he had a Buddha statue right next to his bed. Why? Because of this, he wasn't a Buddhist, but the symbol of peace and kindness was something that a person with that degree of stress would really need, and also because he suffered depression as well. That would inspire him, even though he wasn't a Buddhist. It was a symbol of something. That's why we have Buddha statues here. The symbol, what it really means to us. And I think if people would actually stop worshipping sort of the image and worshipping what it represents, we'd have a much happier world, which means that people wouldn't start arguing about Buddha statue is in a garden, it's not being respected. If it brings people peace, brings people inspiration, it's doing its job. Keep it there. Even I remember once I was visiting Buddhist society in Victoria. And, you know, Victoria. And I was there and in this, in the house here, and there was phone call after phone call after phone call, and I was receiving them all. And what had happened, there was a football player who played for Geelong, who people nicknamed the Buddha. I forget what his name was. Anyone remember his name? Gary Hocking. Yeah, Gary Hocking. They nicknamed him the Buddha. And one of the very devout Buddhists wrote to the newspaper and said, "It's wrong. You should not call anybody the Buddha. That's not a right nickname. You should respect religions." And so I had all these, you know what it's like in Melbourne, in Victoria. I mean, their religion is not Christianity or Buddhism. That is AFL. That's their religion. And my goodness, I had all these people calling up and said, "You can't, we can call him whatever you like." And my response to call after call said, "Please, sir, first of all, this Gary Hocking fellow, is he any good?" "Oh, yeah, he's great. If he's okay and good, okay, call him the Buddha. If he's hopeless, please don't denigrate my Buddha." That's the response. I said, "Oh, fair enough. Yeah, he's a good player. Okay, you can call him the Buddha then." Because it was a symbol of something which they recognized from a Buddha, which they gave to this player. This is actually where we notice the difference between container and contents. We can get so angry at people who mock our containers. And we're missing the point. There's something more important than that. So that's my first little story of, you know, can we please let all of our religions know it's containers. They're not so important. The contents, what's actually in there? And if there is something which some holy person said, now what did they really mean by that? And sometimes I still remember that a little quote from Voltaire, which I read as a young man. And he said that if, you know, if there is a God and God was the author of any book, he'd be the author of human reason. That's what he said. But I would actually go further than that. I'd say they'd be the author of not human reason, but human love and respect. That is the book, the holy book, which is written in people's hearts. And that is expressed maybe in this scripture or that scripture. But any expression of that is never perfect, as the perfection which you can feel inside your own heart and mind whenever you meet anybody or whenever you see yourself. That is the holy script, if you like. And it's inside each one of you. And that type of holy text, please believe in that, even much more than, please excuse me, anything you read in the Buddhist scriptures. You feel it inside, first of all. That's one of the nice things about being a monk who's a meditator. You feel it inside, first of all, and then you can actually understand what the Buddha said and why he said it. Because you experience it yourself, first of all. It's a difference between believing in a travel manual, like a Lonely Planet guide, you know, to truth, and actually experiencing it for yourself. Lonely Planet guides, you know, to Vietnam or something. Yeah, you can read all those books, but do you really understand what Vietnam is just because you've read the book? And because it says in there that, you know, this restaurant is no good, please avoid it at all costs. But you go there and it's delicious food and really cheap and good value for money. So which would you believe? The guides are just that, they're guides. Holy books are guides. They're not the truth. Or like I said when I visited Dhammasara last time, to make a point. Because when I visited the nuns' monastery the last time, I think it was one of our committee meetings, when I visited there, I asked, I needed to go to the toilet. Now, they've got beautiful toilets now. This is the old toilet in the old nuns' cottage. And they said, just over there, you can see the sign, toilet. Okay, I went over there and I said, I'll urinate on the sign. I said, you can't do that. I said, but it says toilet. That says toilet, that must be what toilet is. How many of you would go and urinate on the sign which says female toilet? Female toilet. You don't urinate on the sign. The sign is showing you where the toilet is. It's the other side of the door, stupid. But that's what it says. That's the word of the nuns. And the nuns never make any mistakes. So it says there, word of the toilet. Interpret it, or even a more good story about nuns. Sorry, nuns, but I'm sure monks make the same mistakes. This was the nuns in England some years ago. Some of the nuns in England, they were going from one place to another, and they had their driver. Because, you know, monks and nuns, we're not allowed to drive ourselves, so you always have to have a driver. So the driver was driving them and was asking directions. And the nuns said, no, giving directions, so it's straight ahead at the roundabout. Right over the roundabout, straight ahead. Not going round. But that's what you said. That's a holy word. Straight ahead. Does it mean straight ahead? It means, you know, you go there and you go round and the road which carries on straight ahead. That's what straight ahead means. When I heard that, I had to be very careful because, you know, I'm sitting in the passenger seat very often when drivers take me here and there. And when I say, go straight ahead at the red light, I say, when it turns to green. Just because I'm a holy monk, you know, that won't get you off the charge from the police. Now you know the difference between the words and what they mean. The words, the sign, is not the toilet. Go straight ahead at the lights doesn't mean you always go straight ahead. You wait until it's red. There's more information there. So don't just follow words, even holy words, blindly. That gets you into trouble. Yeah, again, that's great guideline. If you go into Vietnam, it's great to get a Lonely Planet guide to Vietnam. But it's for your Buddhists, it's meditate, great to read the suttas. And actually there is a sutta class on Sunday, first of the year, 3 p.m. to 4:15. Here, yeah. Sutta class again. Yeah. And so it's great to listen to those things, but for goodness sake, sort of, those are signs pointing to somewhere. Don't urinate on the sign. Go to where it's pointing, and you'll find these little bowls in there where it's the right place to do it. And don't, that means you understand the mistake people make when they follow Holy Scripture with no sense at all. Find the heart. And trust that. You know that I've done all that all the time with my life as a monk. You know that sometimes you see something and what the Buddha said doesn't make sense. Oops. And it's not the Buddha doesn't make sense, it's just I've misunderstood it. You haven't actually gone there and seen what the Buddha had seen and actually understood what it's really trying to point to and point to what to say, why. Once you actually start to see that, you understand, oh, okay, I understand it now. But just the words are never enough. And please, don't fight a war over toilet signs. Don't sort of blow people up. When you know that this is the heart. Anyone who actually kills somebody else, you can understand what it feels like inside. You've destroyed a life. There's hardly any justification for that at all. Well, Gandhi used to say, I can see 1,000 reasons for giving my life for a cause. I can't see one reason to take the life of another. That's like a holy man. a holy person. That's a holy idea. It feels right and inspires you. And that should be one of the important parts of any religion. It should be inspiring. And as for the words are concerned, we had a ceremony last Thursday at St. George's Cathedral. There's some really nice people. They're trying to sort of do something and to show some harmony between people. It's the only way forward. You can't take off any section of society and push them aside. And one of the things which I always remember the Buddha say, which really resonated with me, you never criticize a person. You never criticize a group. You never criticize a religion. You never criticize the Labour Party, the Liberal Party. You don't criticize any group or person. You criticize acts. You criticize killing, not an army. You know, you criticize lying. No, not a council. You criticize acts. And the Buddha called that, it's one of the suttas of non-conflict. So just, you know, in your own life, relationships, don't criticize you stupid woman. It's a stupid thing you did. There's a huge difference there. Quick story, two kids, supermarket checkout, parallel aisles, one kid dropped a jar of honey. The other kid, almost exactly the same time, dropped a carton of milk. Both went splat on the floor, made a big mess. The mother of the kid who dropped the honey said, "You stupid boy." The mother of the kid who dropped the milk said, "That was a stupid thing you did." It's totally different. One was criticizing the act, one was criticizing the person. I think you know what I mean there, because people have done that to you too often. "You stupid boy, you idiot of a man." What does that do? It means it turns you away, creates barriers, you feel inferior, hopeless. If you do, you're not a bad person, but it's a stupid thing you've done. Yeah, fair enough, I can accept that. Which means you can actually do better next time. So there's no religions which are stupid or violent or bad. There's people who do bad things. Criticize the acts, never criticize the person. And to make that very, very strong, there was a story which I gave at the service in St. George's Cathedral. Hardly anybody went. And no media came, because the media were all down at Esperance, because no one likes good news in the ABC or the West Australian. Only bad news. Except one nice piece of news, which I saw on the ABC website. And I should have downloaded it or something. But there is a religion in the United States. And I must admit, if I wasn't a Buddhist, I'd probably join this religion in the United States, because it really fits me. Or maybe I should have found it first of all. It's a religion which believes in the flying spaghetti monster. It actually exists. You can Google it. Flying spaghetti monster. And it and they say there's enough. The reason they've got themselves organized, they're a valid religion in I think Massachusetts, and they say there's as much evidence for the flying spaghetti monster as there is for God, so fair, you should allow us to believe in the flying spaghetti monster. But the reason why it was in the news is because as part of their religious rituals, whenever they meet together and do their services, they have to, you know, they have to wear their special stuff. And what they wear is like, you know, a colander, like a sieve? They wear the colander on their heads. So that is part of their religious ritual, to wear colanders on their heads when they come and do their services. Fair enough. But this woman, she was applying for her driving license, and she said, well, you know, Sikhs are allowed to have their turbans on when they have their driving license. So she demanded to have a colander on her head in a photo on a driver's license. And of course the government said no, so she took them to court. She won the case.
had a photo of her driver's license on the ABC website with a condom on her head. The most stupid thing I'd seen for years, but I thought if there was a religion and I wasn't a Buddhist, that was the one I would go for. It suits my character. Good on her. So if any one of you, you know, fed up with this place, you can always join the religion of the flying spaghetti monster. Really, I think we should have some, next time we have an interfaith meeting, I'm going to invite them. But anyway, this particular story, which I said at the cathedral, it's a great one. Some of you have heard it before, but to me it's a beautiful one, which gives hope, inspiration for our future. And never, ever give up hope. If you always think bad things are going to happen, that's why you make bad things happen. When you have hope and see possibilities, then those possibilities become real. Imagine them first, and then they make them real. And that was the story. I changed it a little bit from the books which I've written. An old fellow from the bush of Australia. Now, lived on the farm, never ever being into a city in his life before, never having any TV or any internet. And one day he came to Perth, first time in his life. And his family, who went to school and got good jobs, they were taking him around Perth. And he was walking just in one part of the city. He heard this really nasty noise, disgusting noise, terrible noise. But, you know, he was so inquisitive. You know, what was making such an awful noise? So he followed the noise to its source. In the back room of a house, he saw a young boy playing something. What's that? He said, that's called a violin. I don't want to ever hear such a stupid instrument ever again. That thing is a terrible noise. Next day, different part of Perth, he heard the most beautiful, wonderful, sonorous sound. It was just... it almost brought tears to his eyes. So he had to find out what its source was. And of course, you've already run ahead of me. In a back room of a house, an old woman was playing a violin. But she was a maestro. She'd been practicing all her life. And it sounded so sweet that this old man from the bush realized his mistake. It wasn't the violin's fault. It was the boy didn't know how to play the instrument yet. When he heard the violin being played by a maestro, it made such wonderful sounds. And he thought, same with religions in the world. When people don't know how to play their religion, it makes a terrible sound. When they follow the books rather than their hearts, when they pee on the toilet sign, rather than realizing where that's pointing to. That's where they make terrible sounds. But if you see a maestro, someone who really knows their truth, it's always a very beautiful sound. But the story hasn't stopped yet. The next part is the best, which brings hope and inspiration to us. The third day, in a different part of Perth, he heard the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his life, surpassed by a mile the sound of a maestro playing a violin. It's even more beautiful than the sound of the wind in the trees in the bush. It's more beautiful than the sound of the little rivers after a heavy rain, or more sonorous than the sound of the birds in the early morning at dawn. It's the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his life. And that sound was the sound of an orchestra. The most beautiful sound because of two reasons. Number one, every person playing their instrument, even the little person on the triangle, was a maestro of their instrument. They'd been practicing so many years, everyone had mastered the individual instrument they were playing in the orchestra. And most importantly, they had then gone further and learned to play together in harmony. What a beautiful world that would be
If everybody in a different part of religions, different type of Buddhism, no religion at all, whatever faith, belief they have, learn your truth well, and then learn to play together in harmony. What a beautiful world that would be. And for me, that's possible. Why not? So this, to be able to play together in harmony, that to me is one of the big problems. Because Buddhists just go to Buddhist things. Catholics go to Catholic things. And that's one of the reasons I'm proud of this center. You know that, yeah, I come here, you get Buddhist monks and nuns here for 9 months of the year, and for 3 months of the year, you get all sorts of people come up here and give talks. We've had Muslims come up and give talks here. Who was that? That was, I should know him. But we had Catholics, John Shepherd, the Dean of St. George's Cathedral has come here. We've got the Benedictine monks have come here. But anyway, we go and see them anyway. We have a lot of fun together. Especially the previous Catholic Abbot Placid. He was such a good friend of mine. That I used to tell him jokes, because I asked him once, have you ever been to New Norcia? You know, maybe you can't get into the abbey there, but we're monks, we can go anywhere. So, you know, he was taking us around really old buildings, 150 years old buildings, some of the oldest buildings in Western Australia. And as we were going around these really, really old buildings, I asked him, he said, there must be many ghosts in here. I love ghosts, I'm really into ghosts. And he said, no, I'm a Catholic, we don't believe in ghosts. That's what he said. And I said, what about the Holy Ghost? Now I've got you. I never let him forget that one. So we used to have good fun together. Now the wonderful thing is that when we do actually meet each other, and we can build up that harmony, that is actually where you know we can get this wonderful tolerance and respect, which is part of everyone's spiritual path. It's not just learning how to be at peace with yourself, not even learning how to love yourself and love others. But part of love, part of peace is respect. You know, sometimes all we need is a little bit of respect, a bit of understanding. That's all we need sometimes to take away all the seeds of aggression, anger, violence. I think you all know that in your relationship, in your family. Sometimes that, please respect me. You know, I'm not perfect. You know, I have my moods. I do stupid things sometimes, but in respect, I'm a human being. I belong. The lack of respect which are given to people in this world today, that really sort of hurts and causes so much problems to people. How do we actually engender respect for one another and respect, you know, for differences? And there's many, many similes. The old one, which I keep on saying, but it's one of the best. Trees in a forest. Do you respect every tree in the forest? When I first went down to the forest at Serpentern, where I've spent the last 32 years now, I wanted to cut down all the dead trees. They were ugly. Until someone pointed out, in those dead trees were the homes of many animals in the forest. They were actually part of the forest. And you shouldn't cut them down. And I changed my idea of beauty. Now I look at those dead trees, and they're part of it. They should not be cut down. In those is so many animals find their homes. And then I wanted to cut down the ugly trees. No. The ugly trees, the deformed trees, are also part of the forest as well. Leave them alone. They belong. From the forest I learned how to respect all the different trees. Not just even the trees, or the other bugs, the ticks in Serpentine. There's lots of ticks in Serpentine. And there's lots of flies. Do you respect the flies? They don't do anything to you at all. They don't carry any diseases. They just want to explore up your nose. They would go out again afterwards. They're only there for a small time. They've got no business up there. Just let them go in, have a look around, and they go out again. And that's fine. It's just a tiny irritation, that's all. Now, once over in, when we, before we had this hall over here, we did our talks in the, what we call the community hall now. And I remember, I said, meditation, you don't have to worry about flies. It's just a feeling, that's all. And whenever I say something like that, I'm always asking for trouble, because as soon as I shut my eyes, a fly landed right, you know, on my lips. And I realized there'd be somebody opening their eyes and watching. If I just do it away, they'll think Ajahn Brahm's a hypocrite. He tells other people to endure, but he can't enjoy himself. So I decided to endure. You know this bloody fly? It went, it didn't just stay here. It went right around my mouth. Three times. Three times, it wouldn't go. Three times around, around, around. It must have been a Buddhist fly, because it's called circumambulation. We do it on Waisak Day, if anyone of you has noticed that. But one thing, I got wisdom out of that. I got insight, one of the most important parts of meditation. What I found is, it's more irritating here than up here. So once it got past the edge of your mouth, it was fine. But then you had to sort of steel yourself, we could go, it's really itchy around here. But then eventually, so I got great wisdom out of that. So it's part, respect these things. Respect difference. Respect when people do things which you don't like. Because life is like this. Sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cold. So it's not just respecting people, it's respecting life as well. Respecting differences. And that's one thing which I think Buddhism can be very strong at. Respect. And a lot of times when you don't respect people, there's consequences to it. There's mutual respect. Not getting everybody the same, because they can't be the same, and the world will be a terrible place if it's the same, but respecting one another is where we can have some harmony. And that's really important. Because have you ever felt not respected? Any of you, maybe gay, and found it very difficult in those early years, not respected? I, as a Buddhist monk coming to Australia, very few people respected me. And whoever you are, you may be mentally disabled, stigmatized because of some deformity. No respect at all. That hurts. And that's not necessary at all. So if we're going to get greater respect, that is a way to have some greater harmony. But I did say about having a terrorist joke. So this is my terrorist joke before I get too serious. Aircraft. You know, they have bombs on aircraft. So this guy, he goes on a Qantas aircraft, and he finds himself sitting next to a dog. There's a dog on the aircraft, sitting in one of the seats. He said, you can't have a dog on an aircraft, not sitting on one of the seats. And the guy on the other side said, oh, you know, this is security. It's a security dog on the economy class. And the handler said, look, I'll show you how it works. So he sent this little dog down the aisle. And he was sniffing everybody. He sniffed this young backpacker, came back again, wagged his tail, and barked once. And the handler said, oh, that's the code. That guy's got marijuana on him. When we get to the destination, I'll tell the people to arrest him. He's carrying marijuana. Let's see what else is on this plane. So he sends the dog up to business class. And on the business class, there is this well-dressed businessman. The dog sniffs him, comes back wagging his tail, barks twice. Wow, that's cocaine. That's a code for cocaine. I'll get that guy as well when we get to the other end. Let's see what's up in first class. So he sends the dog up into first class, and he sniffs all these really, really well-dressed people, and especially this very well-dressed woman. Comes back, barks three times, wagging its tail. That's heroin. She's a heroin trafficker. We'll get her as well.
Let's see what else is on the other part of economy class. And he goes down to economy class. He sniffs this other person with a wrapping around his head. Comes back, doesn't bark at all. Got his tail between his legs, whining. Jumps on the seat and poos on the seat. What's that code for? That's code for a bomb. Okay, that's my silly terrorist joke for today. Poor old dog doesn't like to die either. But whenever there is, you know, any sort of attacks like this, for goodness sake, yeah, they can destroy life. But as I said a couple of weeks ago, because we had somebody stole some stuff from our monastery. Why do you say all for? They can steal chainsaws, but they can't steal our happiness. They can take away, you know, steal your car, but don't let them steal away your peace and your joy. They can kill our friends, but don't allow them to kill your peace, respect, love and happiness. Don't let them flush away these important things in your life. Because that's what terrorists are there for, to try and flush those things away and make you angry. That's why the other thing which I quoted when I was at the cathedral, the very 5, 6 and 7 of the Dhammapada, I hope I get those right, was, he beat me, he hurt me, he abused me. Hatred never disappears if you carry on thinking like that. He hurt me, he beat me, he abused me. When you don't keep thinking like that, then hatred ceases. Hatred never ceases by more hatred. It only ceases through love, respect, forgiveness. And so we don't want to have a world full of hatred. And if you have hatred back, when people blow up your best friend, then terrorists win, as you all know. So please, never take away your hatred. So never allow them to take away your love and replace it by hatred. Whatever anybody does to you, never allow them to control and take away these beautiful spiritual qualities, which, you know, you've spent so much time building up. Many of you have been meditating, coming to this place or similar places for years. You built up some love, some peace, some kindness. Don't let a few idiots take these things away. Don't let them control you. It's one of the things, I never allow other people to control my happiness, my peace, my love. That is your possession. That is what's really important to you. They can take everything else away. Like Gandhi would say, they can take away my life. They never take away my principles. And that way, we can preserve what we really mean by civilization. Civilization is not the cars and the roads and the freedom to come and go wherever you want. Civilization is the respect and peace and love and friendship which we can build up between one another. The respect, that's part of what I think is civilization. And if we get angry back, then civilization has been destroyed. So kindness, forgiveness, and never think that's a soft option. That is one of the most powerful options. That is one of the things which can really work. It does bring hope, it inspires, unites people. Anger, hatred divides people. Kindness, respect, love, forgiveness, that's what unites people. No matter where they come from, no matter who they are. So that, to me, is the way forward and the sort of response which we need. No blaming a person or religion. Blame the act, yes, but the person is always much bigger than any act. Thank you for listening. Very good. So, I'm sure there'll be a few questions today. First of all, from online. And the first question is from Mustafa from Afghanistan. No?
I make this up. We're coming for you. Zion the Taliban.
Now, here we go. First question, how can we refocus our minds on a meditation practice, compassion and kindness, after we have been in a prolonged state of uncertainty, chaos in our life? Okay, and then that's similar. Someone asked me a similar question beforehand. It's the same as when a person's been in prison for 30, 40 years. They've been in a prolonged state of pain, lack of freedom. And sometimes tomorrow they're about to be released. Can they get out of jails? No, they don't want to go. They got used to the status quo of uncertainty, chaos. So what people do these days, you go out for day release first of all, then you go back inside. Then you go for weekend release, then you go back inside. The release from the chaos and uncertainty of life has to be overcome, transcended, slowly, step by step. And you have to go back again into your so-called comfort zone. You just can't just say, okay, right, 40 years in jail, tomorrow I'm free, and think you can just handle it. You can't. So that's why meditation is beautiful. In meditation, you have half an hour and you're free of all of that. And then you come back to it again, unfortunately. But you get a taste of freedom. As the Buddha said, the taste of freedom. And the more you taste it, the more you want, the more you take, until you can have total freedom. But giving people freedom all in one go, they can't handle it, unfortunately. They're too afraid. So if you've been in a prolonged state of uncertainty, chaos in your life, come to a place of safety like this, or some church, or some beautiful place. Go to the bush, go to the beach, a place where you feel secure, safe, no chaos. And then go back again. You can't stay there all the time. And little by little, you ease yourself into a chaos, uncertainty-free life. Second, how do we begin to feel compassion towards others who have caused so much suffering? There was many people have told me that they go to work and they've got a boss at work. And they call them the boss from hell. Now there's so many bosses from hell here, and some of you are bosses, so maybe it's you. No, not me. Actually, I'm a boss. Am I a boss from hell? Please. So anyway, bosses from hell, how can you feel compassion for them? You only have to put up with them 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. They have to put up with themselves 24/7 for the rest of their life. Now that really sort of hit home to me when I first heard that. How true that is. If that's the sort of mind they have to be so cruel and hard to you, they cause so much suffering to you, imagine how much suffering they cause to themselves, what type of life they have to live. That's where it's very easy to find so much compassion. You poor thing, if that's how you treat me, how can you treat sort of, you know, your wife, your kids, your husband, your family? How can you treat yourself? Because as they treat others, so they treat themselves. That's an ancient law. If they are angry at you, they're so angry at themselves as well. The anger just takes whatever object is in front of them. So when they're alone, horrible life. That's how I feel compassion towards them. Well, of course, it's not just feeling compassion towards them, it's, you know, doing something about it afterwards. That's why even with terrorism or whatever, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. Don't think, oh, isn't it terrible? Do something. At least, you know, become a kinder person. Find something to do. And lastly, we're living in a country with a different religion. How to practice meditation and Dharma path when living in a country with extremists? Are there extremists in Australia? Who's an extremist? Pauline Hanson? That's not the answer you thought. No, and she's, I always say that she owned a fish and chip shop, so anyone who owns a fish and chip shop is a friend of mine. I'm only joking. But extremists, there's no such thing as an extremist.
If you think like that, it's very difficult. There's people who do extremist things, but they're not extremists. There's another part to them. Okay, when I was in Singapore years ago, it's an old story but powerful. When I talk like this at the Singapore Institute of Mental Health, this big campus treating all the people, just in one big campus in the north of Singapore Island, treating all people, not just in Singapore but for other countries, with mental health problems. And after my talk, one of the professors came up, professors of mental health, congratulated my talk, very good talk, I totally agree with you. And as you do, you ask, well, what are you doing here, what's your job? I'm a professor of schizophrenia. I said, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? And he smiled and said, exactly the same way as you said in your talk. I don't treat schizophrenia. I treat the other part of the patient. There is no such thing as a schizophrenic, he said. There's a person who has an episode of schizophrenia. I treat the part of which isn't schizophrenic. And I was so impressed that he understood my talk and my understanding, and I just worshipped him. No, Singapore people, Sri Lankan people, I put my hands up, well done. Because what he said, yes, that works. I had to ask him, of course, what's the results? And I remember him smiling and said, much better than conventional treatment. That's how you treat schizophrenia. You don't treat a person as a schizophrenic, stigmatizing them. You treat the other part of them. Water the flowers, flowers grow. Water the weeds, weeds grow. So how do you treat terrorism? There's no such thing as an extremist, there's another part of them. Water that. Focus on that. Bring that part of them up. There's no such thing as a terrorist. There's a person who does terrorist things. If ever you read any reports, the friends, the mother, the father, they're a nice kid. I can't believe they did this stuff. It proves that there's another part to these people. Huge part. Not just a terrorist act. But if you focus on the terrorist part of them, the extremist part of them, it actually builds up the extremism. Please water the flowers. Don't water weeds. Anyway, that's my answer. That's what I think would work. Any comments from the floor? Okay, very, very good. So I hope you enjoyed the talk. Some you may not agree with, some you do agree with, but it doesn't really matter. I'm sure there's some parts of it which made sense to you. So please take those away. Okay, now we pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can all go and do whatever we need to do.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami.